Hi everyone and welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast. I'm your host and co-founder, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Kieran Smith. How are you, Kieran?
I'm very good, Laurie. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Can you just tell the listeners a bit of background about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I've been coaching for about 14, 15 years maybe. Played at a decent level when I was younger, then got injured, couldn't continue and then just got straight into coaching. I'm originally from Glasgow. I live in London at the moment and I've lived in a number of different places, but originally from Glasgow. So started a few qualifications with the SFA, moved down to London when I was 21. And then kind of that's where my coaching career kind of took off, if you like, in terms of working for professional clubs. So when I first came down, worked for Fulham, Tottenham, moved away for a bit, worked for Man City, then was lucky enough to move over to Spain, worked in the third division over there, then worked at a second division club, the under-19s, came back to the UK, went back to Barcelona to work for a club called Europa over there, who are a really interesting and a really important club in Spanish football. They're one of the founding clubs of La Liga. And then was only there for a short period and then came back. And that's pretty much it.
We're going to focus, you know, on the kind of mindset of like working in Spain and, you know, the program you're putting together at the moment. But you moved to Spain, you know, with your girlfriend at the time, you know. But what was your mindset, you know, going there? The planning behind it, the support. How did you try and, you know, fund all this? You know, because it's a lot of, you know, getting up and go. You know, it takes a lot of, you know, that kind of growth mindset. But sometimes it's the fear. But that's the kind of the success versus the kind of failure. Did you ever feel that you were going to fail potentially, or is it one of them you're going to go for it?
No, do you know what? I was 27 when I moved out, and there was probably still a little bit of youthful naivety in terms of I've just backed myself 100%. The reason it came round, so I'd always, since I was 9, 10, 11, always been obsessed with Spanish football. My family had property over there, so I used to go over every summer. So my family having property sounds like we're super rich. My gran moved over there when she retired, and we used to go over every summer. And I was always kind of, you know, whole Barcelona, Real Madrid, Valencia at the time. Like it was just kind of it was a bit of an obsession. And then as I started coaching, I got more and more involved in the Spanish philosophy and methodology, and I'd been over a few times to visit a number of different clubs, Villarreal, Barcelona, Real Madrid, quite a few different clubs, and I was going well in coaching in the UK, and then I kind of hit a bit of a glass ceiling where I was earning decent money in my day job and coaching in the academy in the evening, and then any job I would get full time in football wouldn't pay me the same amount of money. And I wasn't really getting the opportunities I felt that I had worked for. And I know a lot of people feel like that. But then it just got to the point where I thought, no house, like no mortgage, no kids. I'm 100% sure I can do this. I back myself. I'm going to do it. And then I think really the planning that went into it was choosing where I was going to go. Literally, I say that as if there was a lot of options, but there was literally going to be Barcelona or Madrid. And in the end, I chose to go to Madrid just because it had a few more professional clubs, because in my misunderstanding of the Spanish system at the time, I was like, if you come to London or you go to Glasgow, you want to work for professional clubs, you want to, like, London has about 15 professional clubs, but that doesn't mean that there's only 15 clubs you can work at a decent level, and Spain's very similar. But I went, okay, I'm going to go to Madrid because they've got Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Getafe, Valladolid, which isn't that far away, Leganés, they've got a number of different clubs, Rayo Vallecano. So I went, fine, I'll get a job at one of them. And then I think the planning of it took 3 months, maybe 3 months, if that. Literally just, where am I going? What am I going to do? I went over to look at apartments to rent. I'd never been to Madrid before. The first time I went to Madrid was to sign the contract for the apartment. I went to view 4 apartments in a day, and I signed one the day after when I was coming back, and then that was it, really. I just made the move. I had a girlfriend at the time who supported me, and she said, if you feel like you can do it, I'll come with you. And I said, fine. And it sounds a little bit bad at the time, but I was so kind of fixed on doing it that I would have gone by myself. But that, I suppose that's a different thing. But I was just so sure in myself that I would be able to do it. And I backed my, and at this point, I didn't speak any Spanish. I didn't know anybody in Madrid. I didn't know where nice areas were. I didn't know where... I literally didn't know a single thing, and I just went, I'm going for it, I'm going to back myself to learn the language and get a job, and I just went, really, that was it.
Yeah, now that's that kind of growth mindset, you know, but also having that, you know, not having that fear of failure, you know what I mean? It's sometimes people, if you fail, you're actually, you know, it's like, all right, who cares, you know what I mean? But if you fail, yeah, you keep on going, you keep on going. You, as you said, you worked in Madrid, you know, with a kind of number of clubs there. Yeah. Could you tell us your kind of day-to-day kind of... what you were doing, you know, because I've seen one of the podcasts, you were working from potentially 6 a.m. to 10 o'clock sometimes, you know, and the, how did you kind of survive, you know, because obviously the language is a big thing, but as you said, if you have that kind of way of thinking of, I'm going to back myself 100%, I'm going to work, 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 how did you kind of get yourself to that kind of next level?
Well, I think, so initially, there was a lot of work that went on before I even got that first job, so, because I just went, to every single club I could. So then, Spanish clubs are great in that a lot of them have their own facilities, and by facilities I mean they've got their own pitch. So from 4 o'clock to 10 o'clock, you see the under sixes, sevens, eights, all the way through to the first team train a lot of the time. So I just went there. There's some more well-known clubs like Canillas, who have a partnership with Real Madrid and stuff like that. So I'd go and see them. But then I went to see as many as possible. Then literally out of blue, I get a phone call from a guy called Alex Gallardo, who had just become the manager of AD Parla B, or AD Parla B. And he found out who I was. I used to write for a Spanish magazine called Football Tactico. I used to write in English and in Spanish for that, just doing analysis. And stuff like that. I did like a big World Cup thing. I used to write analysis on the Premier League every week. I did the big my Atletico Madrid presentation, which is online. They put that into the magazine as well, which was great. And so I had already had some, without even realising, I had a little bit of a reputation in Spain. So then he gave me the call, and that was the third division. Now that's still part time. Like they say, part time. They train in the evening, but we would train every night. So we would train from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. because of the sun and the heat and stuff like that. But they had their own facilities. They had their own home pitch, and then they had another training pitch. So I was working during the day. So I would finish work. So I was teaching at that point in schools. So I would be there for 9, and then I would go to... So Parla is like a suburb. Like for someone like yourself who's from Glasgow, it would be the equivalent of going to like East Kilbride from Glasgow.
Yeah.
Right, so it's outside, so it's a suburb. So I'd have to travel, and I lived in the north of Madrid. So I'd have to travel, and the suburb was in the south of Madrid. So I'd have to travel all the way down there. But then every day, so we had a meeting at the start. So we literally came in pre-season, new manager, new sporting director, me as the assistant manager or coach, whatever you want to call me. And at we had to have a few meetings at the start of, this is the players that we've got, this is who we're trying to bring in, this is, they've just been promoted from like the equivalent of the conference to the third division, how are we going to attack it, we've had the youngest squad in the league, and it was, we have players, it's semi-pro at that point, so now players are starting to get paid, you've got decent players, you've got a lot of obstacles in front of you. But then in terms of the training, we train Monday to Friday and either play on a Saturday evening or a Sunday morning. And then, yeah, just pretty standard from there is me and Alex would work out what we were going to do in terms of what we were going to work on. So that was the kind of the sink or swim moment for me in Spain is first job, I'd had to have a couple of meetings in Spanish, which was really difficult because it was five people talking at once, trying to hold my own, making sure I didn't make any mistakes, to then... The first session was for 45 players, 42, 45 players. And they just said to me, right, on you go. So this is pre-season. And I was just like, cool, it's a sink or swim moment. Mm-hmm. I just had to walk into the middle of the circle of them and just kind of own the situation and kind of get my own credibility up and get them doing what I wanted to do. And that was it. And it was literally, when I look back on it, I think, geez, I don't know how I managed to do it in terms of get over the fear of doing that. Because it was massively frightening and daunting to go and stand in front of 45 Spanish players of a decent level and speak to them in a second language, which I wasn't particularly good at the time. I was decent, but I wasn't fantastic. And then control the session. And then we whittled down the team, and then we had pre-season, doing all the friendlies, this, that, and the other. But I did most of the coaching, to be fair, on the grass. So Alex and I, he might do some fitness bits, and then he would stand back as the manager and observe and chip in with little bits. But I would put the sessions together. I would do the coaching and stuff like that, and then we'd kind of work together. But yeah, so then we'd finish at 10, and I'd have to travel home. So I would get home at... So we'd finish at 10. Alex and I would have a conversation about 10:30, 10:45, put everything away and all that sort of thing. Then I'd have to travel back, so it was like a bus from the facility to the train station, and from the train station I'd have to travel back. And if I missed the bus at midnight, I used to have to walk like a mile and a half home. So that happened a few times. So then I'd be up at, I'd get home at 1, I'd have to eat something, then I'd get to bed, then I'd have to be up at 6 o'clock the next day. So it was pretty full on and pretty intense.
And that's obviously, but as you said, that's a grueling part of it, but it does work.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's the, if you want something, you know, I always remember, you know, hard work does pay off, but sometimes you, I know Alistair McCaw talks about having that energy, you know, how do you, you know, how do you create that energy with the players, you know, because sometimes if you're working every day, you know, between say 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, and then 4 o'clock to, you know, 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and then to 10, you know, it's about 17, 18 hours you're working, you know, five, six times, a week. How do you create that energy? Is that just to do with how much you want it, or is it because the passion you have, or a bit of both?
I think it's both, you know, because like, even when I worked in London, we trained Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, played Sunday at the academies. So I was doing the same there when I lived in London, because a lot of the academies, like Fulham's is in Motspur Park, or Tottenham's at the time was at Chigwell, so it's outside of London as well. But you've just got to taste it. Like for me in Spain, like to this day, there's no better feeling for me in football than standing on a pitch in Spain, coaching in Spanish, the style that I want to coach. That like literally that is living the dream for me. So the fact that I got the chance to do that, I wasn't going to let it go lightly, right? And I know that sounds like some sort of Rocky movie montage type thing, but that's literally what I thought, like, because when I went to Alcorcón after that, so I was at Parla for 3 months, I think, and then I went to Alcorcón. Alcorcón had a team in the second division, doing really well this season, actually. They were top for a bit, and now I think they're sixth or seventh. But I went there initially as the coach, the assistant coach of the 18s, and I got promoted after about a month to the 19s, and the 19s is called Clubes de la. That's the if you're not with the B team or the first team, the 19s is the one you want to be with. So I was lucky enough to work with them. But that was a very different challenge, because I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. Being there as a foreigner at times was very, very difficult, because you're different, right?
Yeah.
And I'd come as this unknown Scottish person or British person as far as he was concerned, and I'd just gone straight into one of the best roles at the club, and people were jealous of that. People wondered why, where it came from. Nobody knew about my background and who I'd worked for and stuff like that, but I'd, honestly, just every single week was a test. Every single week was a test in terms of, so we'd play on it again, normally play on a Saturday, sometimes on a Sunday, but we, every Monday, I'd go in there, all the fire in my belly, ready to go, politics and whatever else would happen. Tuesday, right, let's keep going. Wednesday, literally get to Thursday, and I'd be like, what am I doing here? Like, it was so frustrating at times, but literally, it was only as soon as I walked off the pitch. When I was on the pitch, none of that mattered, none of it bothered me. As soon as you walk off the pitch and you've got a million one different politics to deal with and things just because you're different or you're a foreigner or, you know, like little annoying things. But literally, honestly, for the 18 months or 2 years I was there, it was like that every week. There wasn't a week that went past when I didn't go, I can't keep doing this. But then I'd have a day's break, I'd go back onto the coach, back onto the pitch to coach, and I'd forget about it. Yeah. So it was a very difficult and frustrating time throughout being there, but it was so rewarding and I learned so much.
Yeah, definitely. And I can see hear the passion, you know, through you at the moment. You know, just talking, I know a lot of people listen to this, I kind of got potential A licenses and pro licenses, and I know potential that the pro license now you need to have a second language, you know, as part of the kind of criteria. Do you think that having that second language, you know, speaking it basic and then going out there and actually going to work, you know, in a different country is going to benefit you or the coach better? Because I know there's a, you know, like Graham Potter, for example, you know, went to Sweden.
Yeah.
You know, he probably took a lot of lessons to speak Swedish. And, and then even Carlo Ancelotti, I believe he learned 5 languages in 5 months because he had to learn the different ways of, you know, the culture at Chelsea when he was there.
Yeah.
Do you think that is kind of, obviously it's going to help in later life, but do you think that's a key aspect of the kind of learning a second language, which will help with the kind of, you know, as you said, the politics, you know, helping the support staff? Do you think that's the kind of key aspects of the kind of growth mindset?
Yeah, I think learning a second language in general, like you say, is amazing. It's such a life skill to have. But in football, if you want to work abroad, it's such a big thing. Like you think for me, right, Spanish in Spain was my thing. It always has been. But and within that, you're lucky that a lot of countries speak Spanish. So it opens up the doors of opportunity for South America, for Spain, for, like I'm saying, like for me to transfer over to Portuguese wouldn't be that difficult. I've had to read books in Portuguese and it's pretty similar grammatically, and a lot of the words are very, very similar. So it just opens your world view up to books that you can read, people you can speak to, jobs that you can take, like you say, just cultures that you can understand. And it's so important. As I think I mentioned it, I can't remember which podcast I was on, but we had a couple of players from Bulgaria, under 21 international, sorry, one player from Bulgaria, a couple of players from Romania. But it just be like learning little bits, little words here and there, like going away and finding out a word and then speaking, just saying the odd word to them in their own language, that their face would light up. I did it with a Chinese boy who was there, like their face would light up. It's that little bit of effort that makes all the difference. Like someone, you know what it's like if you go over to on holiday, even maybe holiday's not a good example, but say you went over to Barcelona recently, right? Say for example you're out and about and you're struggling to say something, and then someone in a shop just says something in English and then shoots you a little wink because they know that you're struggling a little bit. You know how much more comfortable do you feel in the situation? Yeah, so if you've got another language, you're laughing at that point. And I'd say for me it opened up so many more learning opportunities as well.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the positional play, because I know that's the kind of the new project you're going to start. We'll do that kind of later on. But you came back to the UK after, you know, 2 years, you know, and you started doing webinars and guest appearances.
Yeah.
You know, I was lucky enough to see you, you know, and Inspire.
Inspire.
And it was brilliant. You know, as you said, an hour and a half, and it's only 10%. You know, of everything.
Yeah.
But I was listening to one of the podcasts. I think it was with Gary Corneen, and it said like, one person only did the work. You know, why do you think people kind of struggle with that kind of extra bit of work? You know, because you said there was maybe 50, 60 people that have, you know, took the course, you know, the webinar, and you just said little task and only one person. Do you think people are afraid to fail, you know, of these things, or afraid to, do you know what, I might not get this right away, but I'm going to, you know, ask for help? Because I think the biggest thing for me is if I ask for help, I think it's a sign of, you know, a strength, because people think it's maybe a sign of weakness. But I'm just looking at, you know, from a person who's been in the kind of industry for a long time, you know, I'm just wondering, how do you think, you know, coaches at all different levels kind of might struggle, you know, to get to that kind of level if they struggle with understanding something?
Well, I think that's kind of the answer to that's kind of twofold. I think the first answer is, I think we're still living in a shortcut type of world in football coaching. It's less so than before, but I would still say the percentages of people who are prepared to put the work in are much lower than the people who just want a book of sessions or anything like that. Like, to give you an example, I've got a Rondo's book, and it's not that long, but it's mainly drills, right? It's a bit of information, but it's mainly drills. And it's a little bit about how, right in the start, about how I got interested in Spanish football. I had a trial over there, that sort of thing. And someone sent me a review well, sorry, an email kind of reviewing it, saying, yeah, that stuff at the start was okay, but could we just put more drills in? And I think that's fine, and obviously that bit of the story isn't for everyone. Like, it's just trying to give you a little bit of understanding as to how I got this passion and why I studied it so much. But this person just wanted more drills. They just literally bought a book to get more drills. Bought a book just to get more things that they could do. And there's nothing wrong with that. But when you do stuff like a webinar or something like that, I think people just want to, like, how many times do people buy a book, whether it's Soccer Tutor, whether it's Jed's book, whether it's Jed Davis's book or anything like that, and they skim through the first couple of bits and then they get straight to the drills. Or they want, what can I use today? And that's kind of what I wish.
That's it. Thing. You know,
and the thing is, the theory behind it is so important. Not for everything, but for something like positional play, it is. And that's why rather than put a book out, I've moved it to the course, because the information's got to be dripped on there, and it's just not. Yeah, there's going to be drills that you can go on and do if you want to go on and look at them. That's fine, but the information is really important. But to answer the question, I think one side, I think with people doing the webinar, for example, and not doing the course task, I think they just said, nah, I've watched the webinar, I get it, I've maybe taken a few screenshots, and that's fine. I get it, which is quite a strange mindset to have, in my opinion. Not a mindset, but the thing is, not even doing the course task, I had very few emails. I had a lot of lovely emails afterwards saying, I really enjoyed the webinar, that sort of thing. But not many people asking follow-up questions, which I think is strange, because we're talking about one of the most in-depth and complex game models, and no, there was hardly any follow-up questions from like 300 some odd people, which I think is strange. But also in terms of the fear of failure, I think, yeah, of course, some people have got a lot of pride and maybe they don't want to ask for help, but if you speak to anybody, who's made it to a decent level at anything, they've asked for help. Maybe it be inadvertently. They've just said, how do you do this? How do you do that? Can you explain this to me? What does that mean? Does it need to be, I don't understand this, can you help me? Right? So when someone maybe uses the terminology, can you help me? Maybe that's when they feel a little bit weaker or in a weaker position. But there's nothing wrong with that. You've got to do it. I'm a big person and asking for help. I'm pretty good at things that I do, but I speak to Wayne Burnett, who's the 23s coach at Tottenham Hotspur and a really good friend of mine. I speak to him for help, and I'll say, Wayne, what do you think of this? Like, I've been looking at this for 2 hours now. Am I going crazy? Does this make sense? Right? And everybody needs to have a sounding board, and I've got many other great friends, but that I can go to and I can do that with, and everybody needs that. But I mean, you think, like, one of the biggest things that people go, oh, Johan Cruyff and Pep Guardiola, they're exactly the same. And it comes so easy. But if you actually look into it, pretty much everything that Johan Cruyff did was intuition, and he did it based on gut instinct. Everything that Pep Guardiola does was researched. He asked so many questions. He went to visit so many people. He went to speak to Bielsa, to Juan Malillo, he went to Mexico. He went everywhere. So there's intuition, and then there's methodology, right? And everyone goes, oh, it's just the same. It's a cookie cutter. No, it's not that at all. You have to go and find out about the work that someone like Guardiola did, and still does, but did, to get the information. Yes, he had a fantastic grounding in it in terms of he played under Cruyff, but that doesn't mean he didn't go and study it. Right? That's why people go, wow, why didn't he just take the first team job? He didn't know if he wanted to be a coach, so that's why he took the B team job at the lower level, and then it worked, and then he moved from there. Right? But he still asked for help and still went and studied and went everywhere. He went to Italy. He went everywhere. Yeah. So he did all that work even before he got the job. And so if people like that, that's probably the most respected coach in the world at the moment, and probably will be until he retires because of the fantastic and genius level work that he has done. But if he's prepared to go and do that, why isn't everybody else?
Yeah, definitely. And you see it, you know, like I go to a lot of, well, the same as you, a lot of CPD events, you know, and usually it's about 3 hours round about them, but the first hour 10 is the theory behind the session. But you can see people are just standing, you know. And I did a comment and said, yeah, I don't really care too much about the theory. I just want to know more drills, you know, because I can do this, you know, tomorrow night. But some of these, as you said, some of these you know, coaches that are the highest level, you know, what a show you work, you know, this is the theory behind it, the context behind it. But you know, you said there's a lot of people just go potentially on YouTube or, you know, at least, and they just look, all right, I'm going to do that tonight. And it could be an under 21 drill, another 19 drill, you know what I mean? And they've got 10-year-olds, you know, and they're not, they're demanding the best, you know. But just kind of moving on, you've kind of, as you said, you've got a kind of growth mindset, but sometimes we all fail, you know. But how do you kind of deal with failure? As you said, you know, do you have a support network behind you to try and, you know, because as a coach, sometimes you kind of run out of energy and you need someone to rant to or speak to. Who do you kind of speak to about this kind of thing, or do you just kind of have that kind of hour away? Because I know a lot of coaches go for a walk, you know. You know, I remember one of the coaches, I know he leaves his, he has a phone in the morning, but at night time he leaves his phone inside the house and goes for an hour's walk just to clear his head from the, you know, the training session. It may be a great training session, it may be a shocking training session, but I'm just wondering, you know, how do you kind of deal with failure, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a quite a strange mix of emotion and logic when it comes to that, because I'm quite an emotional person in terms of wearing my heart on my sleeve, and I'm quite intense when it comes to coaching. Like, that's, and I take that as a compliment because I do care about it that much. Not intense in terms of intimidating, but just intense in terms of the standards that I've got and what I expect of myself and everyone else. But I think it would probably depend on the type of failure, to be fair.
What if it was a failure of a, let's say you didn't get something right away, you know, like a session and it broke down.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes, you know, because there's a lot of kind of, there's a blame culture in the moment, you know, with if a session goes to pot, it's usually the coach, you know what I mean? Because the coach always takes responsibility. But I'm just seeing, you know, a lot of the things is through communication or it's not explained to an extent.
Yeah.
Let's do two examples, one in England and then one in Spain. You know, how do you kind of, you know, because sometimes sessions do break down, but how do you kind of, you know, build that trust again and build that confidence in the players, you know?
I think the first thing that you've got to do is, and it can be a blame culture, but if you're the coach and you're leading a session and something breaks down, you need to, I'm big on evaluating every session I've done. I've got notebooks upon notebooks upon notebooks of evaluation of sessions, of my own sessions, and marking things out of 10 and what went well and what didn't, and if I'd put in like a point for improvement, did I actually improve in it? But I think that if it's a session or if it's an exercise within that, the big thing for me is everything's got to be linked, right? And I'm doing it for something on the game day or to do with the game model or the style of play or whatever. And I always have to, I think it was maybe a Sven-Göran Eriksson book I read, or maybe it was a Jose Mourinho book, and it was called, the coping mechanism was called mirrors and windows. And if something goes wrong, you have to look in the mirror. And if something goes well, you have to look out the window and see who to give the praise to. And that's something that stuck with me. I'm sure I read it maybe like 2007 sometime. I'm almost certain that it was a leadership book about Sven-Göran Eriksson. A really good book. I can't remember the name of it. I'll try and find it. Yeah. But you've got to look at yourself and first and foremost. But that doesn't mean it's your fault. So you can look at it and then it could be a breakdown of a bad attitude of a player. You didn't have the right equipment. You didn't have the right size of... you didn't have the right space to do that specific exercise. If you didn't, then you've got to look back at yourself. Well, I should have been able to adapt that at the time. And that comes with skill and experience as a coach. But yeah, I would look at it logically. I would be pissed off afterwards because that's how I am. Like, I'd be annoyed at myself that it didn't go well. And we've all had those sessions. We all get them. I think in if I was looking at Spain, I didn't have it happen that many times. I had probably the best example is I had a breakdown with a player. So when I was at Parla, I was new to Spain, made a couple of mistakes when I was speaking the language. It was difficult to integrate with some players. And like, if I made a mistake, they would like try and make fun of me. Nothing bad, but just like take the mick. But it was one player. So I just got to the point where I had to speak to the players. I'm like, look, obviously I'm going to make mistakes, but let's just carry on with the session. And the one player that wasn't there, and I said to them the day before, I said, look, if we get to this point again and things break down because of this, I said, I'll just send you in to get changed. I said, we don't have time. We've got a game in a couple of days, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, player comes back the next day, does something similar. I said, right, off you go. Like, go and get changed. And he absolutely lost the plot. I mean, lost the plot, like, was shouting, screaming, whatever. And he's a 20, 21-year-old boy. And he was going crazy. And he'd, like, shouting. And I was like, cool, on you go get changed. He comes back. And I think the thing is for me was I was absolutely right in what I did. And the good thing is I had the backing of the other players. I just probably didn't communicate it well enough to him, because he wasn't there the day before and he was confused and he was an emotional person as well. And again, that was, his behaviour was not acceptable at all. You can't speak to people like that. You can't shout at coaches. You can't shout at anyone. You can't do that. But maybe I lit the fuse by how I communicated it, by being so blasé about it, because I was to everyone else, but then I should have remembered that he wasn't there. Yeah. Right? And that's, again, I'm not responsible for his reaction, but maybe I sparked it with how I communicated. And that's a failure on my part. And that could have been a naivety of not knowing the language that well. It could have been a cultural difference, because he was a Romanian brought up in Spain and I was a Scottish geezer who just moved there. Right? So there could have been a breakdown. Like, you're from the same place as me. If a coach tells you you're going to get changed, it's not in the politest of terms. Do you know what I mean? It's usually with some sort of off. And there's a bit of swearing, and you know you've learned your lesson from that point, and you're going to get a little bit more afterwards. So maybe I approached it too much like my culture, and not the way that I should have done. Because like, certainly in Spain, they're a lot more emotional with like getting sent off and stuff. I mean, players in tears, players at 25, you know, in tears, and that's just how they dealt with it. That's absolutely fine, but it was very different to what I'd been used to. So yeah, that's probably an example from both.
Perfect. We've got a couple more questions, kind of quick fire. Mm-hmm. We'll leave that to the end. We're going to go into the kind of crux of like GDP. Can you tell us a kind of brief definition of it? You know, I know we've got about an hour, 2 hours, but only probably a couple of minutes. But can you tell us the kind of new project you're kind of working on, and you know, tell us about it a wee bit more, because I've signed up to it. I'm looking forward to it. You know, as a coach who possession, you know, based, but I love how, you know, how specific things can be, and I'll be, you know, working away from away, you know, to try and get better as a coach, you know, to learn from different people. But I'm just wondering, you know, the first part is, can you tell us a wee bit of, you know, the definition of positional play, and also the kind of new project you're working on?
Yeah, positional play is a game model with specific concepts. 12 or 13 specific concepts. Again, the way that I best describe it, it's a way to view the game of football or the game. So every time I watch a match, it's viewed through my eyes of positional play, if you like. And I suppose it's almost a good way to describe it. And one of the ways that I don't know if you call it a module, but one of the articles on the methodology module and the new thing is all about, kind of, it's almost like game theory in football. The positional play is very much like that. I'm doing this so that they do that, just so that I can do this. Which is, or a better way is, I do this, you do that, repeated. Right? So you can do that infinite amount of times. And that's why, like, yes, we've got numerical superiority and creating superiority behind the opposition line of pressure. That's the specific concept within it. That's fine. That's absolutely fantastic. But it is just a specific way to play the game. It's a specific game model that you have to pretty much have to follow the concepts, otherwise it breaks down. And it's best known for being used by Pep Guardiola. He also uses it a little bit. Paco Jiménez was big on it. Thomas Tuchel has parts of it. Obviously, Johan Cruyff was kind of the person that brought rondos and stuff to fame. But he didn't invent them or anything like that. But yeah, as I mentioned earlier, so I'd written a rondos book, and I was approached by a publisher about writing a book on positional play. But we had a number of disagreements in regards to the content of the book, because it's an in-depth and complex game model. You need to know quite a lot of information behind it in terms of understanding the concepts, understanding what I'm looking for, how I'm going to train this, why am I training this way? If I do this but don't do that, why does it break down? Because even teams that use positional play, you see them, once they've got it, they've got it. And then after a little bit of time, it kind of drops off and becomes like needless possession by accident because some things are not happening the same. And that happens at the absolute top level as well. And then you correct a few things. So it's basically, the rather than doing a book that people could pick up, look at the drills and put back down without knowing the theory. And that's not everyone that does that, but I would say it's the vast majority from the coaches that I interact with. It's kind of like an online course. So it's going to have a positional play module where it's going to have a lecture that's similar to the one that you've seen at Inspire. Then it's going to go into the concepts in detail, positioning, why it's important, what's position over possession, quite a lot of different things in there. Then it's going to have a methodology section in terms of how to implement it, what to look for, pretty much everything on the methodology section and implementation. Then there's going to be just a defence section on its own because it's a very in possession based model, because we want to dominate possession while controlling the opposition. So there's going to be a defence section. There's going to be a tactics and analysis section in terms of how to analyse your own team, how to analyse opposition. From that, how to design your own sessions, which goes back to the methodology. If I can see the opposition and I play this way, what can I do to affect the opposition so that I can get my most important players on the ball in the areas that we want them to? So it's going to be everything like that. There's also going to be like kind of quarterly webinars that will be live, but I'll record them. So I think I'm honestly thinking already that the first one's going to be on half spaces. So there's going to be a bit on there on half spaces, but again, it's one of those things that seems to have reared its head on Twitter again recently. Yeah. But it's just a bit of an explanation of what that is and to answer questions. And everyone who's signed up, they'll get to jump onto the webinars. And before that, I'll send out like an email asking for questions, because it's going to be the webinars will be on one specific topic. And then from there, it will have like a Q&A type thing where people who are struggling with maybe a certain thing or they need more clarification, we can look at that. There's also going to be quite a lot of drills on there or exercises, going from rondos all the way to positional games or tactical games or whatever. So they're all going to be animated on through tactical pad, and then from there, I'm actually in the process of filming some sessions so that people can see how I do it and what I pick out, because some of the biggest things is the coaching point. So what is a coaching? Is this a coachable moment, or do I leave it and come back to it? When I do that, what's my questioning path down that to help with the understanding? How do I get players fired up to go in and do what we've discussed? Like on a scale of 1 to 10, where is that player? Are they just nodding their head to get me to stop talking? Or are they fired up and they really want to go in and show me that they can do what we've just decided, et cetera, et cetera. So, there's going to be a lot of stuff on there. So it launches on March 1st. As I said, all the information will not be on there at the start, and that's a very deliberate thing, because then people will read it for a month and then not go back to it. I would say most of the information will be on there after 6 months, and it'll be put on there fairly rapidly. It's not like it's going to be weeks and weeks without any new things going on there. And all the members will get an email when any new stuff goes up, just so that they know that it's there. It's just a more in-depth way of looking at it. Pretty much every bit of work I have on positional play that I've been studying it for 12 years and implemented it at a few different clubs, and spoken to the best, watched the best, tried to be one of the best. It's literally every bit of information I've got, and that's it. So I've been so humbled by how many people have signed up already. I'm trying to get obviously a few more people, as many people as possible, because we're trying to get as many people spreading the positional play mandate. I'm really looking forward to it. It's my passion, and I could talk about it for hours and hours, as you've seen at Inspire, whenever it was. So, yeah, it's looking good.
And just a couple of kind of quick fire questions. Who's the person or the people you study?
What, football wise?
Football wise, yeah.
Guardiola. I'm a massive fan. So Guardiola, in terms of style of play, and training methodology, and to be fair, training methodology is very Spanish or very Barcelona driven. I would say on a communication level, Diego Simeone is a big person from that I've looked at. Paco Gemez as well, because they have the most ridiculously high standards, and they have a very, they have very different personalities depending on what they're trying to do, and are very, very intense, and they work really, really hard. Yeah, and that kind of feeds into to how I feel. But yeah, I would say those were, I mean, I study a bit of everyone, to be honest, but those would be the main people.
What's the best team or you've seen or watched?
It'd be Guardiola's Barcelona.
Okay. What's the best book you've read?
I don't know. Best book I've read? I don't know.
Jed's book, was that decent? Did you enjoy that?
I mean, Jed's book's great. I don't know if it's the best book I've ever read. I would definitely recommend people to buy both of them, but that's quite the title if I say it's the best book I've ever read. I don't know. I'm a big fan of what's it called? Do you know what I like? Extreme Ownership.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called, by the Navy SEAL guys. It's really useful for working with people in general.
Okay. Who is your hero?
I don't know if I have one, you know. I don't know if I've ever had one. I suppose when I was growing up, it was Ali McCoist.
Oh, yeah.
But that's different. That faded quite quickly. Because he was coming to the end of his career when I was growing up. But no, I don't really have one, to be fair. Like, I have people I admire in terms of a hero. I don't really have one, to be honest.
Okay. What are we? Where can people kind of find your work then?
On Twitter, I'm on it as @KieranSmith1. I have mad ramblings on there pretty much every day. You can get me on LinkedIn, which I don't really, I started to post more stuff on there. The site is at www.playpositionally.com. I will be able to, it's still up, there's a holding page and a pre-order page there at the moment, but obviously that's going to be the main site as of March 1st. I have a book on rondos, which you can find if you type my name in on Amazon. It's an Amazon bestseller, which is nice. Apart from that, that's about it. I've been invited to do a few different speaking, or like do a few presentations at places. So if and when they come to fruition, I'll let people know, because it's, as you know, like, did you do the webinar, Laurie?
No, I done the Inspire though.
So I think that's what I was going to say. So the Inspire, being there and being able to ask questions, is very different from doing a webinar. So if I'm ever at somewhere and people want to hear me talk or come and speak to me, I chat to people all the time. I'm similar to you, like my phone is constantly going and chatting to people. So yeah, if I get any of those to go out and speak, then yeah, come and say hello. I'll always make time.
Thanks for listening. If you don't already, give us a follow on Twitter at The Curve Mindset. And please like and retweet the podcast. And also, if you can, leave us a review on SoundCloud or Anchor. Thanks for all your support.